Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly with me, Patrick Jenkins. We'll be talking first about Barclays and the dramatic resignations last week of Chairman Marcus Aegis, followed one day later by Bob Diamond, the Chief Executive. Next, we'll look at the prospect for UK bank bonuses following news that Chancellor George Osborne is preparing to fight EU proposals for bonus caps. And finally, we'll turn to Spanish banks and the possibility that a line could finally be drawn under the disastrous state of affairs for the Spanish banks following a European finance ministers' meeting in Brussels. This week, we are joined in the studio here by Charlene Goff, our retail banking correspondent, Brooke Masters, our chief regulation correspondent, and down the line from Miles Johnson in Madrid. First, though, to Barclays. Charlene, last week was really quite a dramatic week. Everyone knew that Barclays was one of the banks involved in this LIBOR rate rigging scandal. The 20 banks have been embroiled in that whole affair with regulators around the world. But Barclays kind of came to the fore the week, a couple of weeks ago, because they settled this regulatory probe across the world with a £290 million settlement. And they thought they were being very clever about it and resolving the issue early for shareholders. Not everyone saw it that way, particularly the UK politicians. And Marcus Aegis promptly fell on his sword on Monday, but that wasn't enough.
So late on Monday evening, the chairman, Marcus Aegis, who had resigned earlier that day, got a couple of phone calls from two of the most senior regulators in the UK saying, look, this is not going to draw a line under the scandal. We want more action. Basically, we want Mr. Diamond to go as well. Now, what led to those calls was a sort of fascinating story. And by all accounts, you know, there was pressure within the government. They couldn't make that sort of direct and explicit call for Bob Diamond's head. But that was clearly what David Cameron and George Osborne wanted to see. And so, you know, first thing the next day, we got that resignation, swiftly followed by that of Jerry Dalmissier, the chief operating officer. So really just dramatic clear out at Barclays and left everyone a bit shell-shocked, I think.
And Brooke, the following day, I think it was last Wednesday, it seems a very long time ago now, but Bob Diamond was in front of the Treasury Select Committee giving his evidence on the whole affair. I mean, one of the most interesting things that we learnt going into that TSC appearance was through the release of documents that Barclays did just the night before, including a memo purporting to record the conversation that had taken place between Mr. Diamond and Paul Tucker at the Bank of England over part of the period when the LIBOR allegations relate to. What do you think we learned then? And obviously we don't know both sides of the story, if you like, but what do you suspect was going on?
Well, what we know is that during this period from about the collapse of Northern Rock in September 2007 right through to May 2009, off and on Barclays got very nervous about having higher LIBOR rates reported than its other competitors. And at times, they lied. They simply lowballed their estimates of how much they could borrow at.
Because LIBOR is seen, and especially amid the crisis, was seen as a key kind of proxy for financial strength. And people who saw high rates being put in for the LIBOR panel, which is averaged to produce the LIBOR rate ultimately, would kind of almost seen as particularly weak and vulnerable.
Absolutely. And the crucial period that all this surrounded was in October of 2008, which is right after Lehman goes down. And virtually every other weak bank was getting rescued. RBS had already been rescued. HBOS had already been forced into Lloyds. The Swiss had rescued their banks. And during this period, Barclays keeps coming out as having one of the very highest estimates of what it thinks it must pay to borrow. Barclays had announced they were not going to take government aid under any circumstances.
And they were on the verge of getting capital from the Middle East, from the Qatari investors, which was a crucial thing, I think, in this particular note around Paul Tucker.
Absolutely. And certainly by then, the FSA, the regulators, knew the Qataris were coming. And I assume Paul Tucker did as well, although we don't know that. It's not explicitly said. And so Paul Tucker picks up the phone and calls Bob Diamond, who is then head of Barclays Capital, and says, you know, basically, what's up with your LIBOR rates? I'm hearing from senior Whitehall figures. And it turns out to be the cabinet secretary, who is not a labor politician, but basically asking, why is Barclays still so high? And
with the idea that does this mean that, you know, we need to nationalize you?
Well, that's what Bob Diamond thought the conversation meant. Bob Diamond thought, say, like, basically saw it as a conversation as sort it or we're going to have to nationalize you.
Yeah.
He then writes this note to File, which he emails to Jerry Del Messier and John Varley, who was then CEO, that basically says that Tucker is asking questions. Senior Whitehall figures are asking questions and our rate doesn't always need to be this high.
Yeah.
Jerry interprets this email to mean get the rate, the bid down, and they duly drop their bid dramatically within about a week,
half a percentage point or 60 basis point overnight,
70,
basically
70, yeah. 70 overnight. Now, to be fair to them, this is the same day that Alistair Darling signals a rate cut is coming, and HSBC, for example, drops, you know, 0.3%.
They all drop, but not as much as Barclays.
Barclays is double everybody else, and so. And within the week, the rate cut comes and everybody drops and Barclays stops lying. But for a week, Barclays lies because Jerry says, the Bank of England says we should lie.
Yeah.
Both Bob Diamond and the settlement documents insist that Paul Tucker did not mean lie. And I think there it is possible to put a more innocent interpretation on that email than Jerry did.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to hear what Mr. Tucker has to say.
Tucker, we should say, is addressing the TSC on Monday late evening. And then we've got Marcus Ages addressing the TSC again on Tuesday.
So. And we should be hearing from the FSA later in the week as well. So it's, it'll be another week of all LIBOR all the time.
This story will rumble on. Do you think, Charlene, there's more to come in terms of Barclays? I mean, the clear news that they have to announce at some point is who's going to be the next chief executive.
Well, clearly. And they don't have a, you know, an army to choose from in that respect. They've got very few, if any, credible internal candidates, possibly Anthony Jenkins, who's currently head of the retail arm, definitely no one at Barcap, and that leaves them, you know, with very few options. Everyone thinks they probably will go for an external candidate, possibly Bill Winters, formerly of JP Morgan and the Vickers Commission, one of the members there. We've heard other rumours potentially of other very senior bankers being lined up. But we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, you know, it's not going to be easy for them to find a replacement. I think other big outstanding issues are Bob Diamond's payoff.
Yes.
So that's going to be the next fight for the
Vince
board.
Vince Cable coming out today, I think, in favour of a sharply constrained payout.
Exactly. I mean, that's going to be fascinating because Bob Diamond so far has given very little sign that he will voluntarily give up what he's potentially owed by the bank, which could be as much as sort of £15 to £20 million in outstanding share options. Clearly, that would be a PR disaster, you know, just as the bank is trying to present a cleaner reputation and start again and, you know, present the sort of face of doing the right thing. You know, if it's seen to give Bob Diamond sort of close to £20 million, I think it was going to be a very tough one to pull off. So that could be quite an interesting legal battle. And then clearly just on the broader strategy, you know, what it means for the future of the investment bank, what will the new chief executive decide to do? Could we see a more dramatic sort of reform of the bank?
Yeah.
So all these questions.
These are all existential questions.
Yeah, right? And I think it will take a number of months for those to really be fleshed out.
Your point, Charlene, there about the bonus for the outstanding bonus for Bob Diamond is a neat segue into our second topic for the day, which is the European Parliament's proposal for a 1-to-1 ratio of bonus to fixed pay. And Brooke, this is something you've been looking at for some time. It's been around for a while, and then it seemed to gain a lot of momentum a few weeks ago. It's back in the news this week because George Osborne, the Chancellor, said that he was, maybe despite expectations to the contrary, said that he was going to fight this this proposal.
It's really interesting because there's no real political mileage in coming out for bankers getting paid well.
No.
But in terms of practically how you run a bank, even if you think bankers are overpaid, increasing the fixed portion of their pay is a mistake for a highly cyclical industry where they either have to be able to move pay up and down pretty dramatically, or they have to lay lots of people off, which is not good for anyone.
Well, I suppose the European policymakers would say, well, this isn't about moving fixed pay up. It's about constraining bonuses. So we hope that, you know, if someone's paid £200,000 as a fixed salary and they get £1 million as a bonus, what we'll see is a £200,000 bonus rather than £1 million salary.
The problem, of course, is the Europeans, with the exception of the UK, largely don't pay that much, and they have big pension contributions instead, and they don't compete as directly with the US and Asia for talent.
So it's a big issue in the UK more than anywhere else. So this Osborne coming out in favour, if you like, of bankers is a big deal.
Yeah, no, it is a very big deal, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
Whether he can stave off a cap completely is very hard I think it's unlikely because the Parliament feels very strongly about this. By all accounts, the Council does not feel as strongly about this. So maybe they can work out a compromise that the cap turns out to be 3 times or something, which is less. I mean, still not great for banks that want to pay their traders a lot. But trading is getting less profitable. So in a way, some of this will sort itself out as long as the cap is not too rigid.
Where do you see it going, Charlie?
Well, I think from the banks that we've been talking to at a very high level, I mean, few of them have spoken out on the record, but they're genuinely worried about this because they can't foresee anyone standing up against it.
Yeah.
You know, in Europe, like, they're welcoming George Osborne's support, but whether that will be enough to sort of stem it is unlikely.
I think it is significant, the Osborne intervention. I think maybe it's not unrelated to the fact that they've got the kind of biggest banker, if you like, in terms of Bob Diamond out of the way. In their eyes, he was a political issue for them.
Yeah. I mean, the UK banks always talk, and I think Peter Sands, the chief executive of Standard Chartered, you know, came out on the record and said, you know, this will drive, you know, talent away from London to New York, to Asia. I mean, we've heard that argument all the way through the crisis when we've had these increasingly sort of constrained rules around pay in the UK. I mean, to the extent that that's come through, it's difficult to know. But again, they're reiterating those kinds of threats. You know, banks sort of HSBC is already sort of questioning how much it can invest in the UK given the reforms. So, you know, these will have an impact. And, you know, I think the government is just incredibly aware of that at this point.
No, well, interesting that he has taken that line. Our final topic for today is Spain and the Spanish banking system. So, Miles, we just wanted to catch up with the Spanish bank story, which has kind of gone out of the news for a short while, overtaken by some of the more dramatic events we've been talking about in the UK. But it's going to be back on the agenda over the next couple of days, isn't it? Because European finance ministers are going to be finalising, we think, the details of how the Spanish bank bailout will happen kind of within the auspices of a banking union.
Yes, exactly. This is a sort of very important moment for the Spanish banking sector, and I suppose we do have to also be careful because we've had many of these quote-unquote important moments before. But what we are going to see is the sort of details of how the conditions for this money being disbursed are going to be set, and that may well be quite important because we might see things which the government in Spain has resisted in the past coming to fruition, such as the idea of a sector-wide bad bank.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I mean, it's clearly the model that worked quite effectively in Ireland. Is it basically that idea that the Spanish authorities are now looking at?
Well, as far as we understand, you know, there is now this idea that there would be some form of central agency to house troubled assets from lenders, and that this would be funded, because obviously the funding is one of the most important aspects to this. This would be funded by the European bailout money. But there are still, you know, issues which need to be ironed out, most importantly, one of them being devaluation of these assets. You know,
well, that was one of the crucial things that the banks were very sour about in Ireland, of course, when the assets got transferred into NAMA, which is the vehicle there. They were done at a fairly brutal haircut in many cases. But I gather maybe that's the Spanish authorities are thinking that they might not do that after all.
Yes, well, I mean, this is a controversial point. I mean, there is this idea that these assets could be valued at fair value and not market value. You know, one argument to support that is that, you know, the market doesn't really exist at the moment for a lot of these assets. But, you know, the counter-argument is that this will just perpetuate the problems and that investors and other interested parties won't have real visibility on the extent of the possible losses within the banking sector, which is the same thing we've been talking about for a very long time.
It feels like yet another reason for the world to be cynical about the Spanish bank bailout.
Well, yes. I mean, this is, we have said many times, you know, this is a turning point for Spanish banks. This is an extremely important moment. But I mean, this really is an opportunity for the problem to be fixed, not just in the Spanish banking sector, but also in the wider Spanish economy, because we have a very vicious cycle at the moment where banks are not lending to anyone, they can't borrow themselves, and the property market is completely moribund. And so really, if you had some form of central resolution vehicle, as they're calling in this sort of buzz term, then you could possibly start to see transactions in the property market again. And that would go some way to solving many of the problems which are dogging the Spanish economy at the moment.
Well, certainly there isn't a great deal of optimism around Spain still. Maybe this, as you say, will be the thing to kickstart it if those doubts around the construction of a bad bank can be resolved. But for the time being, we're seeing worryingly high rates that Spain is having to pay for new debt.
Yeah, because there's just still so much uncertainty. You know, whatever breakthroughs are made, in the end, the market is not convinced. And, you know, Spain's 10-year borrowing costs are, you know, toying with 7%, you know, going above, going slightly below. But the difficulty now is that that is, seems to be the new normal. You know, what would be the catalyst to make that fall down to a more manageable rate, you know, would really be some real certainty, some real sort of hard details on a roadmap which will be followed over the next 1-2 years. At the moment, we don't have that, and I think probably even the most optimistic observers would not think we're going to get that from the meetings.
Well, let's hope you're wrong and that there is some form of roadmap over the next couple of days. We'll watch that closely, Miles. Thanks very much for joining us. That's all we have time for today, sadly. All remains for me to do is to thank Charlene and Brooke in the studio and to thank Miles down the line in Madrid. For all the latest banking news, go to ft.com/banking. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.